Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans will be in order. Today is Wednesday, April 6th, 2011. Let the record show we do have a quorum, and I have talked to most members, and if we could get the microphones outside, we would be outside right now. Senator Roebling, you're first up, so come forward. First item on the agenda is Senate File 134. Senator Roebling, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I haven't been before this committee yet this year, and I used to be on it for quite some time, so it's good to be back. Anyway, I bring to you today Senate File 134. It's really a rather simple bill that recognizes the changes that have occurred in our workplaces and higher education institutions over the years. It recognizes that students no longer graduate by the time they're 22 years old, is basically what we're dealing with here. A lot of them are coming back to school, as we've seen many people return to work, especially with the employment situation as they've returned to school in order to return to work because of the employment situation. We also have so many veterans who come in under the veterans programs after they've served our country that are over the age of 22. And if you check the bill, we're really just changing a few words. We're just eliminating a restrictions that those under age 22 would not fall. Right now, it's only those under age 22 fall under the non-classified position, and which is regulated by PELRA. And we're just saying that interns that are of any age really should be able to fall under that classification. And so that's what we're asking. Right now, it says that temporary interns who are not employed for more than 100 working days during the calendar year are full-time students prior to being hired and have indicated an intention of continuing their education during or after their temporary employment and are under the age of 22 are exempted from the PELRA Act. And we just want to say we want to also exempt those that are over the age of 22 so that we can include all of those groups that I mentioned earlier that might be adults who have been working, lost employment, went back to school, need an internship opportunity. And quite frankly, internships are a wonderful way to lead into employment at some time in the future after they finish their degree, too. I think that, you know, we have student teachers in the schools, and how often do we find that those same students, after they graduate and get their degree and are licensed, are able to come back to those very same schools that they might have student taught in because the people are familiar with them, are familiar with their work ethic, and know that they would be good employees. And so internships are very, very valuable for people in finding employment in the future. And we just want to include as many in that opportunity as we can. And if they happen to be over age 22 and end up in an internship, under current law, they do have to become in the classified position, and they have to pay their fair share of union dues. And it's just an extra burden that we're placing on these interns who are still paying college tuition and still earning a very low wage in almost every circumstance. And so by changing that they would be excluded from that requirement as well. So that's the bill, and I have Keith Carlson from the counties here who would like to testify too.
Welcome. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 13 of the larger counties here in the state of Minnesota. I have distributed a letter from Doris Krogman, the Human Resources Director for Carver County, in support of this bill. I apologize that she could not join us today because of interviews back in her jurisdiction. I do want to indicate our organization's support for this legislation. Has Senator Roebling indicated, this is a very simple bill. It's simply eliminating the age 22 cap on the current exemption from PELRA for individuals under or over the age of 22. As was indicated, the changes in our workplace, the changes in the past practices of going to college directly from high school have changed dramatically in the past 20 or so years that this provision has been in the law. Individuals may delay going to college because of military service, because of financial circumstances, and that's no reason to deny them the ability to perform an internship and not be subject to PELRA for the limited period of time, 100 days or less, that they would be exempted under this law. I highly endorse this law on behalf of our organization and encourage the committee to pass it.
All right. Are they Senator Wigger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Roebling or Mr. Carlson. Would these employees that would be exempt then also be exempt from any benefits that might be accrued because of their work?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wigger, it depends on the employment practices of the individual jurisdiction. They would receive whatever is provided under the terms of the contractual or benefits arrangements under the individual employer. Many part-time employees, basically under 30 hours a week, do not receive full benefits regardless of their union status. So if these individuals are in a part-time position, frequently, regardless of whether they're covered under PELRA or not, they would not be receiving benefits.
Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Mr. Carlson, you said many might be excluded. What about those where a collectively bargained benefit that also would go to the benefit of a part-time person, what if they're going to be now excluded and they wanted that benefit? What if that was for health insurance? What if the health insurance option that might also be a part of what they're seeking, that they didn't have coverage, was a part of that? And there are real-life examples where people would lose their health coverage, I believe, if we adopted this.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wigger, the only people you're really effectively talking about under this example are those who are working beyond 67 working days and up to the 100-day cap for the intern exemption, because any individual who works under 67 days is not covered under PELRA, and if the terms of the union contract would provide benefits, it only starts on that 67th day. So basically, we're roughly talking about 33 days that they would possibly not have coverage. Again, in the large number of circumstances, the general practice for employers is that part-time employees of, depending from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but frequently 30 days or less do not receive benefits. So in most instances, that simply would not be an issue.
Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can see where you're trying to help the students out. There's new definitions of student, which could be lifelong. But I want to make sure there's not an unintended consequence of a potential benefit not being available that was collectively bargained for by union dues. And health insurance comes to mind. I think of servers. And servers, as you know, don't make $100,000, but they do have, through their union, they can get health insurance. And I don't think you have to be full-time to do that. And there are many students that go to school full-time that also have to work, at least in my district. And I don't know if there's any testimony from labor, but before we act on this, I hope we can get some further information.
Senator Roebling.
And I just want to remind members that this is only for public employees that we're discussing here.
All right. Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But when you say public employees, Senator Roebling, that include teachers and local government employees and state employees? All.
Yes.
Senator Roebling.
I just didn't want members to be confused because Senator Wigger mentioned servers, and it doesn't affect that class or that group of employees.
Are there any other testifiers, either for or against this bill? Please come forward. Please state your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. We represent roughly 43,000 employees statewide, and employees that would be negatively impacted by this change to PELRA. This is simply expanding a loophole in PELRA. If you're one of the folks that Senator Wieger referenced that's getting health care benefits, and now this bill comes forward, and you're the one that's not going to receive the benefits because of removing the age, that's a negative impact to the workforce. It's a negative impact to members when they are not allowed to be under the Public Employee Labor Relations Act in this state. We oppose the bill, and we urge you to defeat the bill. Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still really confused, and I apologize, but this appears to me to be more expansive and not restrictive, and so maybe I just need a little more help here. It appears to be a good thing. Can someone expound on this?
Well,
Senator Roebling
and Senator Carlson, it's my understanding that there may be a few, but very limited number of people who could potentially receive benefits between the 67th and the 100th day that this would allow. It's an expansion of exempting them from PELRA from 67 to 100 days. And it's not a long period of time, and I don't know how many interns actually are eligible or have been able to receive benefits. I think it's a very small number of people. I know that people like student teachers do not have that opportunity. And I don't know if local units of government offer benefits to their interns. I don't think most of them would. But it is just that small amount of time that we are extending it for those who are 22 or over, just to address the age of students that are currently in our universities and college systems, and then it exempts them from paying union dues.
Ms. Bly.
Mr. Chairman and members, don't be fooled by the word internship. Don't be fooled by the word expansion. This is an expansion that takes away benefits from public employees, not gives them benefits. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Roebling.
It is still very restrictive. It said that they cannot be employed for more than 100 working days during the calendar year. They are full-time students prior to being hired and are planning to continue their education after their temporary employment. Those are two other restrictions. Right now, we also have the age restriction on there. All we're planning to do is remove the age restriction.
Thank you. I want to remind the testifiers there is a sign-in sheet at the table. Please make sure you sign in either before or after you testify. Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota, and I'm only coming up here just to clarify to make sure that there isn't any confusion about the student teaching position. These individuals are not paid in any form. They do not receive health insurance benefits or anything like that. So there isn't anything in this bill that changes the status for student teachers because they are not considered employees at all. And we would, support our friends in AFSCME and be concerned about the loss of benefits for probably a few people. But internship can be expanded and could be problematic, I think, and affect workers negatively. Thank you.
Any further testifiers?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Chair and Senator Roebling. Without this, could it not be with current law? Could it might not be a deterrent to hiring interns if it draws them into a public employee status?
Senator Roebling?
Senator Olson, I believe that it could be a deterrent. And, you know, we do need good people working in public employee positions. And I think that we don't want to exclude some of the more mature students that might want to come forward and help and work and get experience in these areas. But if they know that they're going to have to be paying dues and they're not being reimbursed a lot as they work in their internships, it could be a deterrent.
You know, I'm looking at this and the words that are wanting to be changed under the age of 22, and I think we need to be focused on that. But let's move forward. I think, Senator Goodwin, you had your hand up first, and then we'll go to follow through.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Roebling, where in this legislation, not in your particular piece, but where does it say define these employees as interns? Because I don't see an intern definition, which would, and we may assume under the age of 22 that they may be a full-time student only, but there are also full-time students that are also full-time temporary or full-time seasonal workers, but they're not they're not interns per se. So I don't see where this indicates that it's just interns in current law.
Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, actually, because of the student status that is required with this, I don't know who else really fits that. They had to just be students, and they have to be planning to go back to being students. And I don't know that they have to be full-time. I think at this time, full-time employees, I think at this time, if you work over 14 hours a week, you are considered, you can be considered in a classified position. I think it's just 14 hours.
Senator Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, and a lot of talk here about pensions, and I don't know the first thing, so that's why I'm asking the question. Anything in here that affects pension rights or pension levels? Or
yes. Mr. Carlson, can you answer?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coleman, generally, and I defer to there are a number of representatives of the pension systems here, but generally the definitions of PELRA also applies for qualification for participation in the pension systems. This would not have any effect in the long term for participation in the pension system. If these individuals would subsequently convert to full-time continuing employment, they would be covered just like any other individual were they to choose to continue employment. And, Mr. Chairman, if I could just clarify a little bit on the employment, what's the qualification for an intern? They're required to be full-time students before they take this position, and then indicate either by enrollment or by indication on their application that they will be returning to school after they complete the internship. So this is just a practical way of defining what an intern is.
Thank you. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just follow up, because it sounded like Mr. Carlson was a little bit uncertain. And I, like I said, am extremely uncertain. Is there somebody from one of the funds who wants to help or?
Please state your name for the record. And
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Mary Vanek from the Public Employees Retirement Association. Senator Cohen, with respect to PERA, we do have a specific exclusion in our statute for individuals who are hired on a temporary basis who will not be working more than 6 months. And typically, an intern position under this nature would be excluded under that provision. I don't recall our statute specifically on full-time students. I believe it is full-time students who are part-time employees under the age of 23. are excluded from membership in PERA. But if they are over the age of 23 and they are in a position that doesn't qualify under the temporary exclusion, they would be covered by PERA.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The more you listen, the more you can kind of figure it out. I mean, I'm like Senator Carlson, it's a new issue to me, but you know, I see that the public schools don't, for themselves, this does not impact them. But as I read F, this is just about trying to help college students that may not be, they might be over 22, they might be in a different place. And so I see this as a benefit, trying to help some people that are in this situation. It doesn't hurt the pensions. It doesn't hurt the public educators. I don't know why we wouldn't support this.
Senator Lilly. Ms. Vonick, would you remember to sign in before you leave today, too?
Thank Mr. Chair, this seems to be a small but important change in the law. The average student that's graduated from high school today will have seven, not jobs, but seven different careers. And here we are talking about an opportunity to have a life experience, to try something new. That's what internships are about. They're about trying on a new position. They're going to school, they're trying to be trained in a new career, and they, if they're not a traditional student under the age of 22, by reading this the way it currently is stated, they would be excluded from having that opportunity to have a valuable internship to find out how this will work. All this is trying to do is it's trying to allow someone that is a non-traditional student that is over the age of 22 that opportunity, that life opportunity, to have an opportunity to learn in an internship program to find out if this is something that they want to do or not. Yes, there is that possibility of someone that would be excluded from healthcare for 33 days, but I believe, to me, it's more important that they have that opportunity to learn the process of this new career, to try it on and see if it fits. I think this is a really important thing to do to try to help students.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Lilly, Senator, I think that, you know, that's all true if this said intern, but it doesn't, and it's 100 hours or 100 working days, not, I don't know what you said, 30 or so working days. It doesn't say intern. So with 100 working days, that's any age person. This is how it would read, any age person. They can be a full-time in school, so if they mark that on their application that they're a full-time student in the evenings but work full-time days in a seasonal position, then they would be exempt from PELRA under what's happening here. It currently is just to the age of 22, and even that should have said defined them as an intern. If that's what we're trying to get at as interns, I totally agree with you, but this is not what it's getting at. It's getting at a lot, much broader category than just interns.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, if I could clarify a little bit, my understanding from Senator Wieger's questioning is that someone is not eligible for health insurance until 67 days. So the difference between the 67 and 100 is the 33. That's what I was referring to, is that once someone is there for 67 days, if they work that extra 33, that is the period of exposure where someone could be eligible for insurance but not have access to it under this change. To me, it's a very valuable, it's valuable to forego that opportunity to have health care for 33 days in order to have the overall opportunity to have the life experience of having this internship. And I believe that some non-traditional students may not be given that opportunity to experience this internship if they're not a 22 or under year old person. And I think that they would want to make that decision. Am I doing this for health care? Then maybe I'm looking for that full-time position, permanent position. But if I'm looking for that life experience to try this on, find out how it works, then maybe I'm willing to forego that 33 days of health insurance in order to make sure that this is something I want to make a career choice for.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Lilly, I understand that. I mean, thank you for clarifying it, but I do understand that. But what I'm saying is we're not specifying interns in here. So what we may have is seasonal employees who work 3 months out of the year in the summer every year, but they also attend school full time. So now they will be excluded from any Pell Rep protections at all, not just health care, but in possibly not even health care, but any Pell Rep Public Employee Labor Relations Act provisions they will be excluded from. So they could be a seasonal employee 90 days every summer in our parks or somewhere, and could be going to school full-time the whole year. They would be excluded from protections. That's what concerns me. If it was the interns, I wouldn't have a problem with it if it said interns, but it does not say the interns.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To clarify Ms. Senator Goodwin's question, the current definition in the law is that you're not covered under PELRA if you are working on a temporary or seasonal basis and you're not working for more than 67 working days, which is basically the 3 months of summer. So this hypothetical that somehow seasonal employees who work during the summer are going to be excluded from coverage under benefits that may have been negotiated, which is pretty much hypothetical at this point, just doesn't exist. They're not covered right now.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could we get clarification from counsel on that? That may be all true. I'll be totally willing to admit I'm wrong, but I just would like clarification on that.
Mr. Bodder.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin. I think Mr. Carlson is referring.
Could you use your microphone?
Oh, beg your pardon.
Thank you.
Mr. Carlson is referring to the language you see on line 1.17 of the bill. That's existing law, and that does basically say seasonal employees who are working for not more than 67 working days, regardless of age and any other educational status, are excluded from the definition of public employee. So I think that would be about 13 weeks.
Thank you. Senator Roebling, I believe this will go straight to the floor. Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 134 be recommended to pass.
Roll call. Requested, please.
Roll call has been granted. Senator Daley moves that Senate File 134 be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair?
No. Senator Wigger?
Yeah, maybe on just a lighter note, I wanted to just acknowledge the importance of internships. And when I was in college, like most of us had internships, I had one at Lilly Suburban Newspapers. And it did not pay, but it gave me incredible exposure to the community.
And look where it brought you.
And they offered me a job, and I took it for 2 years. Didn't have benefits, but appreciate that.
Thank you, Senator Wigger. Secretary will take the roll.
Chairman Perry?
Aye.
Senator Carlson?
Aye.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Daley?
Aye.
Senator Dibble?
No.
Senator Gazelka?
Aye.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Lilly?
Aye.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Torres-Ray?
No.
Senator Wieger?
No.
On a vote of 7-5, 7 yeas, 5 nays, Senate File 134 passes and will move to the floor. Thank you, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of committee.
Next item on the agenda is Senate File 646. Senator Hamm, welcome back to the committee, Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I have brought you for your consideration Senate File 646, which is a bill with respect to the Public Employee Insurance Program. And I do have, I believe, a couple of folks who would like to testify. But this was a proposal that was first brought to me by a constituent who works in the insurance sales field. And the purpose of the bill is to ensure that we have a level playing field for coverage in the marketplace and also to prevent the loss of general fund dollars. I think also to give us as policymakers an opportunity to weigh in on what I think is a significant policy issue. Over the past number of years, there's been a trend in the public employee groups to consider moving from the private market into the Public Employees Insurance Program, otherwise known as PEIP. which is like a CGIP administered by MMB and is why the bill is here in committee. And the impact of having employees moving to PEEP is significant. PEEP does not pay the premium taxes and assessments required of commercial plans. And so if you have a large-scale movement of public employees into PEEP, it would result in a hole in the general fund and an increased burden on small businesses to make up the difference in their payments to fund the high-risk pool that MSHA represents. In the past, the legislature has addressed the issue of pooling school employees with bills that required the proposed pools to compete on a level playing field with commercial plan options. And like this bill, those proposals included requirements to pay into the state high-risk pool, pay premium taxes, and offer the same consumer protections as fully insured health plans. These were important provisions and were designed to prevent cost shifts to the small employers and individuals in the fully insured marketplace. So this bill would establish a level playing field by requiring all public entities entering the PEEP structure to pay the same taxes and assessments and abide by the same consumer protection statutes as they are currently doing in the fully insured market. So 3 points. Number one, the insurance pools for public employees should not be established without policymakers having a chance to weigh in on the policy decisions involved. Secondly, the state government should not provide incentives to individuals who are currently privately insured to move into a government-run pool that is essentially being subsidized at the expense of the small business and individual purchasers. If we continue to shift more cost onto the private market, it would, I believe, have an impact, a negative impact on job creation, make it even more difficult for small businesses and individuals in the fully insured market to buy affordable insurance. If we do not pass this bill, the state's general fund stands to lose significant, perhaps millions of dollars, from loss of premium taxes currently being paid by the commercial market. And as I said, we have a couple of testifiers here today who would also like to comment on the bill.
Thank you, Senator Hand. Please state your name for the record, and you may proceed, and please remember to fill out the sign-in sheet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit, and I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which is a trade group that represents the 7 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. And I do have a copy of a document that I'd like to pass out if the page is available to pass these out. This is a just a pie chart. That shows where Minnesotans get their health insurance coverage. You're going to get this shortly. But this is data from the Minnesota Department of Health, and it gives you a snapshot of where we are as a state in terms of how people access health insurance coverage in the state of Minnesota. As most of you know, most people access coverage through their employer. However, employer-sponsored health insurance can take two forms. One is fully insured, which is typically... Well, let me just use my own example. As a an organization of 5 employees, we don't have the reserves or the finances to be able to self-fund. So in exchange for a premium, we purchase a health insurance product. And we, by giving the premium to the health insurer, we are transferring the risk to them to take care of us when we need health insurance benefits. That's called being in the fully insured market, and that portion of the market is right up here, this upper right corner, which is roughly about 25% of the total population. I would also venture to say that this 25% is probably even smaller today, given that these numbers are based on 2009 calculations, and since then, I think there's been, with the downturn in the economy, I would imagine that more people have lost health insurance in the fully insured market. The biggest piece of the pie is the self-funded market. And self-funded insurers, that's large employers typically who have the resources available, including, for example, the state of Minnesota, who are able to self-fund. They might hire a health insurer or some other organization to administer the benefits, but essentially they are the ones who pay the claims or provide the finances for paying the claims for their employees. And what's special or what is advantageous for a large employer like that to self-fund is because they are not subject to any of the state requirements, state laws, state mandates, or state taxes. And so that's what we're talking about in this legislation. What Senator Hand's bill does is simply require groups that are moving out of, so groups that are moving out of this portion of the market into the self-funded market, into the PEAT market, would also have to pay those state taxes and assessments. And the reason for that is that small employers and individuals typically make up this piece of the pie, the fully insured market. They can't afford to jump out of that fully insured market where they pay 4, 5, 6% more in premium to the state for taxes, mandates, and other things like that. They simply don't have the resources to jump into the self-funded market. And as a result, as more people have been incentivized to jump into the self-funded market, the cost of those mandates and taxes continues to build on the remaining portion of the population who are left in the fully insured market. As Senator Hand mentioned, this bill really addresses the pricing advantage over other health plans that PEEP would have if it were exempt from the taxes and assessments. And that would create an unlevel playing field for other plans in an already highly competitive market. We just think that this is the wrong direction to go in, to be moving people from who are currently paying these types of taxes and assessments to move them into a self-funded market where there would be greater cost shift to small businesses and individuals and loss of revenue to the state. And with that, I'll turn my testimony over to Ms. Bodine.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Bodine, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber represents approximately 2,600 businesses throughout the state. 70% of those businesses are under 50 employees, many of them located in your communities across the state. The Minnesota Chamber supports Senate File 646, the bill that requires that people joining the public employee insurance program pay the same taxes and assessments that they're currently paying in the fully insured or private market. The MCHA assessment, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association assessment, for the state's high-risk pool, as already mentioned, is currently only paid by the fully insured market, which for the most part is made up of small businesses, self-employed folks, and individual policyholders. And as Ms. Commit mentioned, according to the state and federal laws, public programs and the self-insured groups are not required to pay these taxes and assessments. The remaining fully insured market then currently only represents the 25% of the total market. We know that this percentage continues to decline each year as folks and businesses leave the private market or are not able to offer coverage to their employees any further. As a result, this percentage of the private industry is bearing a disproportionate share of the taxes and assessments, the MCHA assessment. So we know that as this market continues to decline, the risk is only spread out over a smaller percentage of the market. If more people move out of PEEP, the MCHA assessment will be assessed across this smaller division of the market, driving up the cost of health care for your small businesses in your districts. And as you know, insurance is a major issue for small employers. It's a recruiting and retention tool. It is the number one cost issue that businesses have. And we have serious concerns about this large percentage of the population leaving the fully insured market. When the state, and also just to mention that when the state exempts itself from these types of taxes, we believe that it really puts a fully insured market at a disadvantage. We also believe it divorces the state from feeling the burden that the private sector feels in these type of situations. So we support Senate File 646 and appreciate and thank Chairman Hand for bringing this forward. Thank you.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Bodine, just quick question. And I understand what you're saying about small businesses and being involved with a small business of sorts myself. I understand the problems. But can you quantify what the problem is in terms of what costs are being passed on to business as a consequence of this in terms of a dollar amount?
Sure.
Ms. Bodine, before you do, would you, for those that might not know, explain what MCHA is and before you move forward? Because I understand we have such large amounts of viewers and listeners to this committee because of Senator Cohn and Dibble being part of it. Is that correct?
It's your tie. They want to see my tie.
But yeah, please do the acronyms. We're trying to just make sure everybody understands.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Have you been receiving a lot of letters?
I have
referencing me and Senator Dibble.
Because of your two's input, they send me emails and letters saying it's good to see the debate back and forth.
Yes. I'm sure they do.
Mr. Chairman, next time you'll have to pay closer attention to Senator Dibble and myself when you write your bill in.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cohn, if I may ask Ms. Commit to explain the MCHA assessment, and then I'm happy to answer the follow-up in terms of the actual impact to business.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, MCHA stands for the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. It's an organization that was created by the state in 1977, and it essentially is a high-risk pool. It's Minnesota's high-risk pool. For individuals who are unable to purchase coverage in the private market, this is a place where they can go to purchase coverage. The way MCHA is funded, it doesn't get any state dollars, but the way MCHA is funded is through two ways. One is through premiums that are collected from the individuals who are covered by the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. The other is... let me back up. They pay a premium, but because this is a relatively very unhealthy population, they don't pay enough in premium to be able to cover the cost of all of the claims that are incurred. Therefore, it's maybe roughly half. It can vary. So half of the cost of the MCHA losses are borne by the premiums. The other half, then, is spread across the fully insured market, so in the form of an assessment or a tax. So that's where the MCHA assessment comes. And so, again, the MCHA assessment, it can only fall on the fully insured portion of the market, which is roughly 25% of Minnesota's population. As people jump out of that segment of the market to seek to avoid paying taxes, to lower their health insurance costs, etc., those MCHA costs and other costs, other taxes, don't go away. They, in fact, just especially the MCHA assessment takes up more of the overall premium that those employers pay in the fully insured market.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, we have noticed that, as I mentioned in my testimony, the decline in the fully insured market has continued to erode. So several years ago, it was 27%, 26%, now it's 25%. And what the trend partially is due to employers dropping coverage altogether because they can't afford it. They may be the five employer group that's down your street. They, you know, may be a nonprofit that's in the fully insured market. They may, in some cases, enter actually the self-insured market, which is traditionally, let's say, a Target is a self-insured corporation. They may themselves enter, as a small business, the self-insured market, which puts that business at significant risk in terms of covering a major loss claim. So they're exiting the market for a couple of different reasons, either because they can't afford it or they are seeking other options that they may think are more accessible from a cost perspective.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
I'm sorry, that maybe I didn't clarify my question because that's not an answer to it.
Oh.
Okay, we've got a 10-person business, whatever. Maybe it's a small law firm, small whatever. What additional costs would be absorbed by that business in terms of a quantified amount, $100, $200, $1,000, as a consequence of what's going on with PEEP right now?
Okay, I understand. Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, sorry I misunderstood your question. So as the percentage of fully insured market decreases, so as that 25% becomes less, they're sharing the disproportionate sum of the MCHA assessment. I believe that some preliminary numbers that have been run on if PEEP were to exit the self-insured market is somewhere between $40 and $50 million in an MCHA assessment over the next biennium. So that would require that the 25% of the market then bear that additional cost of the MCHA assessment that will then leave with PEEP, with the changes that this bill would prevent to PEEP. If they leave the market, that additional 40 to 50, let's call it half, 20 million, is now spread across the 25% of the fully insured market. So those businesses will bear that percentage spread out across that marketplace.
Okay.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, run this to the ground. So if we use the $20 million figure, in terms of your membership, again, what would be the cost, the additional cost to, you know, the 10-person business?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, perhaps I can state it a little bit differently. So typically, let's just say a small employer's health insurance benefit or health insurance premium for 1 year is, let's say, $25,000. And I know there are some people who are in the insurance business here, and I'm hoping that I'm gauging that right. Roughly, let's just say $5,000 per person in premium. Yeah. So when the MCHA assessment continues to grow because costs continue to grow for this population, the MCHA assessment is typically 2% or so of that premium, so 2% of $25,000. If I have just learned that the MCHA assessment is estimated for 2011 to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5% or more percent. So when you have fewer people to spread that across, then, you know, if those losses are, let's say, $300 million, those losses have to be spread across a smaller pool of people. So that's how it has a direct impact to individuals purchasing fully insured coverage.
Okay. Right. Mr. Chairman, those numbers are helpful.
All right. We have a list, and here's the list so everyone knows. We have Carlson, Gazelka, Goodwin, Dibble, and then back to Goodwin. So we're going to go over to Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would like to just remind members why we have the Minnesota Comprehensive Healthcare Association. And Minnesota's a leader in healthcare from that standpoint, so that anyone who is not able to get healthcare in a traditional market because of their health condition, pre-existing conditions, for the cost of 20% higher, it's 1.20 over the average cost of the health care is offered for that age group. Of the insurance premiums for that age group, for only 20% more, they get the same kind of health care that any of the rest of us that are healthy can get. Now, keep in mind that if you come in to, and I sell maybe five insurance health insurance policies a year, so I'm not a big health insurance carrier. So, but I know this because Senator Gazelka and I, because of the fact that we can sell health insurance, if someone walks into our office and they are not able to get health insurance through normal means, as licensed agents, we're obligated to make sure that we can sign them up for Minnesota MCHA. When you walk into an insurance agent's office, and I take an application for your health insurance, the health carrier has three options. They can either take the off-the-shelf rate that I'm quoting them out of my rate book, or they can come back and say, because of a health condition that you have or a pre-existing condition, we decide that in order for us to accept you into our plan, we would have to rate you up. And they can rate you all the way up to 50% higher than the normal premium. Or the health insurance company can say, you're just not a risk we want, so we decline coverage. So those are the three options that a carrier has. When a carrier comes back and denies, in many cases it's actually cheaper for the insured, for the individual, to go to MCHA, because keep in mind that the MCHA rate's only 1.2
percent, 20% higher than the normal average rate for that group. And so I might have offered them a plan at 40% higher, but in fact they can go to the Minnesota Comprehensive Healthcare Association for only 20% higher. That's a significant advantage to those people in the state of Minnesota that cannot get it. And as the testifiers were talking about, we have a dwindling amount of people that are paying into this wonderful program of being able to insure unhealthy people. Keep in mind that everyone that goes into MCHA is guaranteed. It's guaranteed. They will use at least one time, if not two or three times more than the premiums they pay in. It's guaranteed. They know it's a losing situation. So those of us that have private health insurance, those in the private sector that have these small plans, again, are paying a larger portion. It's a wonderful program. I don't understand why, as all Minnesotans who, and I believe we're trying to achieve some fairness in the health care insurance so that people of all health conditions, that they can get health care, I would think that we would want to spread that out across all premium payers. And so I thank Senator Hand for the bill. I think this is a great idea.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Carlson, there you go, stealing my thunder. But so I won't say anything that Senator Carlson talked about, but I think we're talking about businesses here when we talk about fully insured, but we've got to remember that this is farmers. This is maybe a spouse that doesn't have health insurance. This is a lot of people that aren't businesses. This is the employees of a small business owner that doesn't provide health insurance. So they go out and get this themselves. And so that's why this is important. MSHA is important. And I couldn't agree more with Senator Carlson that I hope the long-term direction is that we don't take this small section and pass all the extra costs on to them.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hand, or maybe our person from the chamber here, this graph you handed out says private self-insured plans. Now, that also includes private industry plans, for example, Target and so forth. They don't have to pay into MCHA because of ERISA, correct?
Right.
Okay, so we're saying now basically that we want people that are covered under PEEP, under basically government self-insured plan, to have to pay into MCHA. But private industry, we can't make them pay into MCHA. So the problem is that there's this whole big group, 38.4%. How much of that group is covered under ERISA and not, that's private industry, that is not subject to MCHA? That we can't do anything about. So here we're saying the taxpayers should pay this, but the private industry can't pay it. So now we're making up for it through the taxpayers.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, so everybody who's in this private self-insured plan segment of the pie, none of them pay premium taxes, none of them pay the MCHA assessment.
Right.
None of them have to follow any of the state mandates or requirements. And it's in part because these are large, multi-state corporations that have employees across the country. And the federal ERISA law exempts them from having to follow 50 different state requirements. They are, I just want to say that these corporations, these large employers typically are very competitive and want to provide excellent benefits for their employees and very very often do that. But they also want to have the flexibility to be able to provide, rather than having to provide 50 different types of benefits and be subject to 50 different state laws, to be able to do it in one way.
Well, Madam Chair and Ms. Committee,
Senator Goodwin,
that was not my question. My question is, how much of this 38.4% is private industry versus a government public employees program or whatever? What percentage of this 38.4% is private industry that does not pay into, we can't make pay into MCHA?
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, I don't really know the answer to that question. What I do know is that most of these people are in the private
These are employers, so they're typically not government entities. However, I know the state of Minnesota, in fact, and I'm not sure how many employees are covered. I know we have someone here from MMB who could answer that question, but I'm guessing that there are over 100,000 some Minnesotans and dependents, it's probably a higher number than that, who are covered and considered are exempt from paying the MCHA assessment. So the State Employee Group Insurance Plan, CGIP, does not pay MCHA, and they would also fit into this piece of the pie. And that is something that the legislature could do something about.
Correct.
Thank you.
Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
My hair hasn't grown that much this afternoon.
No. Ms. Commit, I understand that, but my point is that a lot of this 38.4% is private industry that does not have to contribute to MCHA. So the part we're asking for in this bill is for taxpayers to pay that extra into MCHA, but not, we can't ask private industry. So we are saying let's have taxpayers pay into it instead. Well, let's take this piece of the pie. But we can't, we're not going to be able to do anything about that piece.
Senator Hamm.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I guess to that point, I would just say that, as Ms. Commit mentioned, that some of that is beyond the reach of the state of Minnesota to deal with, although we could argue the merits of that structure, and Ms. Commit has made the point about the nature of many of the large corporations that have multi-state business. However, what our bill is trying to get at is there are people right now currently in the fully insured marketplace. That's where they are now. They are contributing to funding MCHA and contributing to bring funds into the state general fund. That's what's happening today. And what they're contemplating, many of them are contemplating, some have done, is to move over into a public plan that does not pay those assessments. And so the effect on taxpayers, I guess if you want to think of the private insured community as taxpayers, they are going to see a large increase in their assessment as people move over to the P plan. So we can argue about whether we should take people who are currently not paying these assessments and ask them to. That's a different policy question. This is a question of saying these are groups of folks who are already paying the assessments. And the argument is, should they be permitted to avoid those assessments by going over to a state-run pool rather than staying in the private marketplace? That's really what the bill is suggesting.
All right. We have two, and then I'm going to ask two more senators, and then I'm going to ask, I know Ms. Alzwager wants to testify, so Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Han or to the witnesses. How would you respond to the perspective that some of these smaller jurisdictions, whether they're school districts or cities, that are in fact having a hard time? I mean, there's a contention in your write-up here that there's a highly competitive market, but certainly the experience that was related to me as I was pursuing the statewide school employees insurance program, which had the MCHA and the premium tax provisions that you're pursuing, but I'll get to that in a second. The experience that they were having as that idea was being proposed is that there wasn't a highly competitive market. In fact, they were kind of a captive audience, and they weren't getting a lot of competitive bids. And so they were looking at paying pretty high premiums and either passing those along to the employees almost entirely or just having to bear tremendous expense, to Senator Goodwin's point, taxpayer expense. And so we're looking to the PEEP as an option to see if they could get a bid from the PEEP, and the PEEP was providing a fairly competitive option, having two results, returning second bids from these private insurers that were a little more competitive because suddenly they didn't have a captive market anymore, or allowing them to take advantage of that better efficiency in the marketplace because, of course, they were joining a greater pool. So now what you're proposing to do is, rather than providing an even playing field, you're kind of knocking the feet out from a competitive marketplace and foisting a new tax. Senator Limmer was fairly sharp in his questioning of me imposing a new tax as I proposed the amendment last week. So we got a new tax on folks who otherwise wouldn't be paying it. And it's kind of retroactive because folks who have these bids and are accepting these proposals are going to have to pay it, even though they accepted them. Advantaging, frankly, a marketplace that hasn't been treating these small entities very well.
Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, the bill that we have does not prohibit anyone from going to PEEP. All it says is that if you are going, you have to continue to pay the assessments you are currently paying. So if the only difference between the plan I have in the private market and PEEP is the taxes, that should not in and of itself be the incentive to bring people into PEEP. If they've got a better plan, if PEEP has a better plan and it's got a better deal and a better and the taxes are a part of that, then go for it. Do it. The bill doesn't prohibit that. All it is suggesting is that if the lure is simply the avoidance of the taxes, that should not be sufficient to bring people into the public plan.
Well, Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, I think what's happening is suddenly, all of these entities that have been writing fairly uncompetitive business, and, we're not talking about companies that are hurting for cash. We're hearing about these vast reserves that they're sitting on, these profits that they're making. One of them returned some of those dollars to the general fund. Others have agreed to cap out their profits.
Those aren't profits. I thought these were nonprofit corporations.
Supposedly nonprofit. That's why it's such a big issue right now. Exactly. Thank you for making my point.
All right.
So writing a business that's not competitive, and now suddenly they've got some competition, so they're looking to disadvantage other competition. With rules that are pretty straightforward, as Senator Goodwin pointed out.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator Hamm.
Senator Dibble, to your point, the only competitive distinction are the taxes. That would be the only impediment to someone who would not choose to move to PEEP under this bill. This doesn't prohibit anyone, any group, from moving to PEEP. It's just saying, if you're going to do that, continue to pay the same level of assessments you are currently paying. It's not, if that is the competitive disadvantage, then we've got a problem with our tax structure, which may be true, but that's not really the subject of this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
That is absolutely not the only competitive advantage. The advantage is the efficiency of the PEEP. CGIP is a great example. PEEP is just as efficient in terms of how well it's funded, its administrative overhead, the fact that it's returned dollars to members that we got. It's in the CGIP. I don't know if the PEEP did, but PEEP's experience is very similar to CGIP. It's much, much more efficient for a lot of reasons that are self-evident. Mr. Chair, I have another question, and it has to do with this write-up. It says, with PEEP, the state takes on additional financial risk for each member organization because it must set aside funds in the form of reserves to pay for health care claims. Other health plans in Minnesota have appropriate reserves in place to pay claims. And maybe Mr. Morocco, I see him in the audience, can help answer that question. Is that in fact true? I understand that the reserves in place for self-insured entities come from the premiums themselves, and the reserves to pay claims don't expose the state. And in fact, perhaps in the startup phase, there needs to be a reinsurance product that's purchased for the purpose of setting aside reserves, but eventually over time sufficient reserves accumulate. That's the whole concept of self-insurance. So is that bullet point in fact true?
And before you introduce yourself, Mr. Morocco, I apologize. I was so tunnel-focused walking in here. I walked right by you, and now I'm thinking you were looking at me and I didn't say hi, so hi. You can introduce yourself.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division. I oversee both the CGIP and the PEEP program. Senator Dibble, to your question, you caught me texting, but I believe the question had to do with reserves and how they're built. There are no state dollars in the reserve. They, like the CGIP program, they come from the entities that participate in the program. So the PEEP program, because it is all local units of government, any dollars that go to manage the program, which includes the reserves, are coming from the entities that participate. So we would essentially have an increase on the premium to build the reserves and to manage the reserves as necessary. Or likewise, if we were over-reserved, like we've been in the CGIP program in the past, we will decrease the premiums to lower the reserves.
So we can strike that bullet, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wigger?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of the questions, I believe, have been asked, except I was wondering, is there a fiscal note showing impact for state, local school districts, other applicable entities?
Senator Hahn.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wigger, there is not a fiscal note. As I understand, there is no fiscal impact to the state.
We have another testifier that...
excuse me.
Mr.
But Mr. Chair, that's your understanding, Senator Hahn, is that our fiscal staff's interpretation as well, there's not a fiscal impact on government?
Mr. Lundeen.
To the state or...
Mr. Chair and Senator Wigger, there is a request in for a fiscal note. It's not yet completed, but I have talked to staff at MMB, and the Department of Revenue says there will be no administrative costs. There will be some revenue estimate that will probably have to be requested on that. That's a separate process from the fiscal note, but as far as there being any costs, I'm not aware of any.
Senator Gazelka.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe a fiscal note's not going to show this, but if we have a large number of school districts that move into PEEP, we're no longer going to collect the premium tax, which I think some estimates have said like $30 million into the general fund that we're going to lose. So I don't know if that can be calculated as a projection, but it's going to definitely put a hole in our general fund over the long term.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Yeah, and I did confirm that that does go. I was running around wondering if that was general fund or healthcare access fund. But Mr. Lundeen, has a local impact note been requested? Would that be reflected in the fiscal note, or does that need to be requested separately?
To my knowledge, there has been no request of a local impact note.
Thank you. How would we do that? Can I just request one from the table here, or should I put in? I think there will be a significant local impact to school districts and cities.
Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. Education Minnesota strongly opposes this bill, but I also want to say thank you to Senator Hahn for bringing the bill forward. The reason I say that is because it really does expose how unlevel this playing field would become. This is not a bill to level the playing field. This is a bill that would segregate out one group of people and say you're going to pay something that other people do not have to pay. Why is this bill here? Kind of been dancing around the situation. Let's talk about it. We have tried, Education Minnesota has tried for a number of years to pass a statewide health insurance pool for all school employees, and we have met vetoes. So you said, the legislature, previous legislature said, even I believe Senator Hahn has said, it should be voluntary. It should provide, there should be competition. That's what we have done. On our own, Education Minnesota has been talking with school employees across the state, and they have been going to PEEP to get a bid. We had 14 school districts in PEEP. Now we have approximately 220 school districts, school employees, I should say, going to PEEP voluntarily to get competitive bids. We have, when we had the 14 districts, not one administrator wanted to go with us, but they went in. What they have seen is a 23% decrease in premiums in Moose Lake, a 2% decrease in Detroit Lakes. Duluth school employees will save, the school district will save $1.7 million on July 1st when they go into when they continue their second year into PEEP. This is voluntary. It provides competition. So what happens? Because this is a system that is working, and we anticipate great success, there is a bill offered to make it less competitive for us, to assess school employees who are going into the plan more than the service co-ops. They're self-insured. Why are they not being assessed? Who else should be assessed? Education Minnesota is very open to talking about who else should be assessed. In our statewide health insurance bill, for the last couple of years, Education Minnesota says we'll be in the statewide pool and we will pay the premium tax and the MCHA assessment, even though PEEP isn't, even though the service co-ops aren't. You know why? Because we wanted to make sure that those people continued to have the funding. But that game's not there anymore. The pool isn't there anymore. We went voluntary. We went through the competitive route. And now because of that, we would be assessed. Take a look at the chart. How anybody can say that this is leveling the playing field? Because if you look at this gray part here that says private self-insured plans, those are the ones that are not paying paying the M10 premium tax. What you would be doing with this bill is carving out a little slice of pie there for the 220 school districts and saying, but you are going to pay it. They would be in a self-insured pool, but you would now be saying to them, we're going to treat you differently. Your playing field is more uneven than anybody else. So to anybody who says that this is leveling the playing field, it's just not true. Teachers are making, the average teacher is making, beginning teacher is making $33,000 to start out. The highest paid teacher in the first year is making about $42,500.
Salzweiger, I don't think we need to go down that route. I think you've stated already clearly. I think I want to stay here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Hand.
I don't know, is Ms. Allswager done with her?
Mr. Chair?
Can we let her finish?
I think Ms. Allswager's point is extremely relevant because the level of premium that some of these teachers are paying in direct relationship to their salary is significant. That's interesting information, particularly in this uncompetitive environment. So I'd like to hear that point.
Well, Senator Dibble, I would disagree. You know, if we can be specific, if she wants to be specific and tell me their premium's going to raise by $2.53, I'm okay with that. We don't need to belabor and go over something that we've heard over and over and over again, and that's the salaries and incoming and those that have been there. What I'm interested in hearing, what's it going to raise? And if we stick to that point, by this bill, is it going to affect you? By how much is that going to cost an employee? $2, $5 a month? What is it going to cost? That's what's of interest, because then you tell us the story of the impact that it has as far as the premium.
We're setting up and distorting a marketplace here. That's interesting to me. You may be interested in the dollar amount per employee, which I am also interested in, but we're also talking about distorting a marketplace that we have established here, and that's interesting to me.
Well, if we want to talk, Senator Dibble, about what's interesting to me is why aren't we putting everyone under CGIP? If we're talking public employees and we want to include police, fire, teachers, then let's talk about having one program where you get your best bargaining power rather than two or three different programs. And I have yet to hear anybody come forth and say, hey, you know what? Let's everybody go into CGIP because we would have a better positioning to bargain. I think I heard you say by going into PEEP, they would save $88 million. I think you said that on the floor. If that's the case,
a year, Mr.
why aren't we? Why aren't we?
A year.
Pardon?
$80 million a year.
That's what I'm talking about. Why aren't we going and establishing a one program for all public employees if that's the benefit?
I'll draft the bill and I'll seek you as a second author, Mr.
Well,
Chair.
I think we should
look
be talking that way.
Mr. Senator Hand to be our third author.
Ms. Allswager.
Mr. Chair, I was simply going to point out that through this competitive bid, our teachers are going to save money in terms, and the school districts will save a tremendous amount of money. Can I tell you the exact percentage? No, because it's going to be different for every district. I certainly wish I could. But we do have teachers, school employees, who have family premiums of $28,000 $38,000. We have six districts don't have health insurance. I also want to point out that when these numbers at the bottom of the sheet where they talk about the independent analysis of the impact over biennium is X million dollars on this one handout, I do not know who put this out. I would like to know who put this out. But, you know, depending on assumptions, wow. I mean, I can say depending on assumptions. So I would like to see those exact assumptions to get to those dollar amounts. And I believe a number of the school districts are already in the service co-ops. If they go from the service co-ops, they're not paying the MCHA and the premium taxes. I think there's a large number of those in the service co-ops. So that's not a cost because they're already not paying. Our solution is let's talk about a method where we can fund MCHA like we should and premium tax. And I believe that we should look at everybody who is in this gray area who legally can pay it or else not do it. Because if you vote for this bill, you are actually separating out school employees who are going after this bid in a voluntary manner and a competitive manner, just as you have asked, and charging a tax on them.
Senator Hand.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I know that we've kind of had a far-ranging discussion here, but I do want to make the point that this bill is not about teachers. It's about any public employee group. That's first. Traditionally, PEEP has been a rather small pool. I think it's had about 2,000 members. Historically, it's now up to about 4,000 members. It's now 4,000 or so in the last year or two as the movement has changed. And that really has been the reason to bring the bill. When Ms. Allsweiler was talking about the statewide insurance pool that the teachers were bringing a few years ago, and she did mention, they included in their proposal that they would and ought to pay the assessments. So they've acknowledged that that's something that they should do. The point of this bill, and members should remember, this does not prohibit any group from moving to PEEP if that's a better plan or a better deal. The only difference is if you're going to move to PEEP to avoid the taxes you are currently paying and therefore shift a larger tax burden onto the private market, that's not a good deal for anybody. Now, the larger point that's being talked about here is do we need to have reform in our insurance markets? Absolutely. But I would say that reform ought to be to how do we construct a more robust private marketplace? How do we get that private group, instead of shrinking as it has been over the past few years, growing again? So instead of going from 27 to 26 to 25%, it's going to go from 25 to 28 to 30. How do we get that to grow? That should be our challenge. If we're going to say our public policy is to bring as many people as possible into a public insurance plan, that's a direction that I don't prefer to go, but that's a policy choice that we can make. What this bill is asking to do is simply to avoid the erosion of the small marketplace for the sole purpose of avoiding the assessments that are funding MCHA and the general fund. And I think that's not a good policy choice, and I would say that this is not trying to solve all the problems that may exist in the insurance world or in the self-insured world. And there may be legitimate issues there, and we can certainly talk about those. But this bill is not to that scope. It is about a fairly narrow scope of whether people currently in the private marketplace should go to a public insurer for the sole purpose of avoiding the assessments.
All right, thank you. I know we have a group of testifiers here for another bill that I do plan on getting to, but Senator Thompson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, the discussion did get very broad. What we're really talking about here is avoiding what economists refer to as a moral hazard, where incentive is created to do things that is not related to a market discipline or market-driven decision-making process. It's no reflection on whether PEEP's a good or a bad program. It's simply saying if we truly believe that this is competitive, you can't then arbitrarily put one player in the marketplace to an advantage or a disadvantage. It would be like if I had a hardware store and, Senator Carlson had a hardware store and I had to pay sales tax and he didn't. That's going to affect the pricing of the products and it artificially distorts the marketplace and would cause customers to make decisions based on non-market factors. And so this truly is a leveling of the marketplace in that it's saying if people are going to choose to go to PEEP, it shouldn't be for a tax avoidance reason. And certainly, you know, for those who are sympathetic to EMCHA, which I would think that would not be a partisan issue here, because EMCHA is a system that provides insurance for people who cannot get it in the private marketplace because of some pre-existing condition, and as Senator Carlson testified to, you are then guaranteed to be able to give to get that insurance at 1.2 times the premium that you pay if you were of normal health. And so we're creating perverse incentives through creating a moral hazard, and B, it may well cut into funding a program that, again, I don't think is a partisan issue that is looked at as something that's worth funding. So whether we're going to talk about a transformation of the health insurance system in general, which I would certainly be up for, I suspect Senator Dibble and I might disagree about the details, but that's for another day. This is about addressing a specific marketplace distortion because we're arbitrarily choosing to tax and charge assessments against Group A and not against Group B. And Senator Goodwin makes a valid point about the ERISA plans, but that's why some of us routinely advocate that it would be better if the federal government didn't do this sort of thing. So you're preaching to the choir there. Unfortunately, we can't make Congress stop that.
All right. This is going to have a lot of discussion when it gets to the Tax Committee, so I'm going to allow Senator Dibble.
One final point. I would agree with everything that Senator Thompson said. If we didn't have a market failure on our hands in this instance, Senator Thompson's points presume that these small entities, these small units of government, school districts, are actually receiving competitive proposals from the outset, but they're not. They're captive markets, and they're getting one, you know, maybe two at the most, proposal from the insurers that are way disproportionate to, you know, what would be justified in terms of the premiums that they're asking these folks to pay. So much so that some have dropped their coverage, some teachers are paying the vast proportion of their salary for insurance. And EMCHA itself is about protecting the bottom line of these insurance companies. So EMCHA itself is about market failure and not covering people.
Mr. Chair, directly to that point, if I may.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, if what you're saying, I'll assume for purposes of argument that you're correct, then the PEEP program can provide a lower premium for reasons other than you can avoid taxes and assessments. In other words, if what you're saying is correct, that there's some oligopolistic influence out there in the private marketplace that is artificially inflating premiums, PEEP can go ahead and charge lower premiums, and they'll still come out ahead if they're paying the same taxes and assessments as the private insurance companies are paying. What Senator Hand's bill, correct me if I'm wrong, Senator Hand, is attempting to do is to say, fine, if PEEP can compete better and outperform the private insurance market, fine, let people go to PEEP, but not for tax avoidance reasons. That's the moral hazard.
Mr. Chair, I didn't finish my points. I was interrupted by
you. You know, I'm really liking this, and I'm always amazed how it always gets to the end of our
Senator,
time period
really
to get into
done.
These
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Senator Dibble, go ahead.
And then, you know, finally, you know, if in fact these arguments were what propped up the purpose of this bill, then why don't we address the co-ops? And why are we making, why are we keeping those who already have PEEP insurance exempt from the provisions of this bill? And also, why are we just simply capturing those folks who have gone out and gotten the competitive PEEP proposals in this last year or so? What's happened here is all of a sudden these folks who are used to writing really expensive business and making a lot of money off it had some competitive proposals, and they're like, whoa, and they're doing what they can to kind of cut these districts off at the pass. They succeeded at getting the bill vetoed last year, and there was an agreement to do the EMCHA assessment and the premium tax. So five, to Ms. Altswager's points, they went out, they got their business, got some competitive business, and now they're seeking another route to cut them off at the pass. Some internal inconsistencies in this bill that I think betray some of its goals.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that Senate File 646 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Taxes Committee.
Senator, request a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Roll call has been requested and granted. Senator Carlson moves that Senate File 646 be recommended to pass, re-referred to Tax Committee. Secretary, take the roll.
Chairman Perry?
Aye.
Senator Carlson?
Aye.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Daley?
Yes.
Senator Dibble?
No.
Senator Gazelka?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Lilly?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Ortman?
Yes.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Torres-Rae?
No.
Senator Wieger?
No.
Being there's 8 ayes and 5 noes, motion prevails. Senate File 646 will be re-referred to Taxes Committee. Thank you, Senator Han.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Next on the agenda will be Senate File 434, Senator Rosen and Senator Pappas. We are going to work hard to get to you, and thank you. I know Senator Rosen has a lot of testifiers, and thank you very much. And we'll work hard to get to you before our 3 o'clock deadline. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's very nice to be in front of your committee and members. And I, too, want to thank Senator Pappas for letting me scoot ahead of her. We do have quite a few testifiers here that are here to talk about the Human Capital Performance Bonding Proposal, or pilot project. And basically, members, it's a major redesign on how we give, how we look at our state services, our public programs. And I think in the past we have not had many examples, except Twin Cities Rise program, that have asked for outcomes or performance measures on the tail end. And this, right now, the state pays for the inputs. We pay at the front end, never asking on the tail end what's, you know, how is this program serving? Are they meeting their benchmarks? Is it accomplishing what it said it was going to be? So this is really a very interesting pilot program that we're starting. Well, that I'm just carrying with. This is a whole group of people, Mr. Chair and members, of 70 different organizations and individuals have come together to support this program to use annual appropriation bonds to fund different nonprofits, unions, state programs that come to an advisory board that is put together that will set these benchmarks for these programs to reach that will show results at the end of our investment. And that's what it's all about. Our state has an investment in a lot of these programs. And unfortunately, with the general fund issue that we have right now, and these programs are getting cut, and eliminated. There's many good programs out there right now that if we paid at the tail end of the program, once they hit their performance measures, when they show that they have a value and we're getting the best bang for our dollar, basically, then I think we can take a general look at a lot of different programs and say, okay, what's the return for our investment from the state? And like I said, there's a packet in your information about there's 70 different organizations that have come to the forefront, but there's many different letters of support from this, and it's completely bipartisan. With me right now, I have Steve Rothschild, who was the founder of Twin Cities Rise, which is an excellent example, and it's kind of spearheaded this whole program. So I will let him go through that. He can explain how these annual appropriation bonds will be issued and how these benchmarks will be set for these programs and the accountability for these programs and for the state and for the taxpayers going forward. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to defer to Mr. Rothschild.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Thank you for bringing this forward. You referred to it as an interesting pilot program. I think it's brilliant. I think it's got some phenomenal potential. With that, if you could state your name for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Rothschild. I'm the president of a nonprofit called Invest in Outcomes that was formed for the distinct purpose of developing this idea and hopefully piloting it in this state and perhaps in other states that have shown interest in it. As you're probably aware, the long-term forecast issued by the state economist over the next 25 years predicts that health care costs will grow at more than twice the rate of revenue growth, over 8.5%. If that, in fact, occurs, health care as a percentage of the state budget will go from 30 to 60%, and with public K through 12 education at 40% holding even, there will be nothing left for higher education, for early childhood education, for anti-poverty programs, for workforce development programs, for environmental programs, for even fixing roads and bridges. Nothing left. $6 billion was spent in this all other category in 2010. And if the forecast is correct over this period of time, it would go to zero by the year 2032. Now, I'm not suggesting that it'll go to zero, but is it likely that that $6 billion could go to $4 billion or $3 billion or $2 billion? That's what we in the nonprofit sector worry about. And we are starting to see the effects of that already. This is a structural issue. It's not an issue of the recession. It's a function in large measure of an aging population that uses more health care when health care costs are going up at a dramatic rate. So what do we do about it? The state can't solve this problem alone. Philanthropies can't solve this problem alone. If one were to take all the assets of all the foundations in Minnesota, they couldn't fill this gap. And so we have looked to private investors as a potential to help invest in human services for the first time. Now, why would a private investor, and I'm talking about banks, institutions, pension funds, individuals, foundations, and the like, but why would they be interested in investing in human services? If those high-performing human services could generate a return on investment above the cost to the state of borrowing the money, this would be of interest to not only the state, the nonprofits, but also the investors. And so we have developed this idea called, we call it a human capital performance bond. It would work in the following way. The state would issue annual appropriation bonds to investors. It would be sold as a plain vanilla AA bond carrying an interest rate at today's market of about 4.2% over 10 years. Organizations would qualify by submitting their outcome data to a group of economists, and their returns would be tested against the hurdle rate to meet the cost of debt service. If they demonstrated that they could generate a return above that, they could play in the game, if you will. And once they reached an outcome, like getting a person a better job or helping them out of poverty in some way, in a very measurable way, they would get paid by the proceeds of the pool. If they didn't perform, they wouldn't be paid. So it's a pay-for-performance model. It's based on investment from the private sector. This thing has been vetted not only by the large nonprofit community, but by bond counsel, by underwriters, by public policy experts, by three former commissioners of MMB or finance in this state from various parties, a number of economists, including Art Rolnick, who many of you know, and they're all in support of it. Because we are concerned that given the trends in available appropriation spending, nonprofits are going to die by 1,000 cuts, and it's already beginning. I want to underscore one thing, and that is that this is not money to replace appropriations. We're not trying to replace appropriations at all. This is to provide supplemental investment, much like the philanthropy sector has done for years, but can no longer keep up with the demands of the nonprofit world. So I think I'll stop at this point. We have some other testifiers who have been working on this, Mr. Chairman, if you're ready to hear them.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, Art Rolnick was supposed to be here, but he did send a letter. He was unable to make it, so there is a letter from him. But also Mitch Perlstein, I believe, is still here. Okay, from the Center of American Experiment.
Welcome. Please state your name for the record, and then you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mitch Perlstein, and I'm founder and president of Center of the American Experiment, a conservative and free market think tank in Minneapolis, and I very much appreciate this invitation. The most enthusiastic response I've ever had to a speech was for the shortest one I ever gave, amazing as that might seem. I'd be happy to tell you about it, but I'm afraid I don't have the time, as my self-imposed charge this afternoon is to describe in under 3 minutes why I believe, in enthusiastic concert with many other policy types spanning an ideological spectrum, human capital performance bonds are, to borrow a word I have just heard, nothing short of brilliant in theory and deserve to be tested in practice. When I wrote the prospectus for American Experiment 23 years ago next month, I worked on the premise that the center would devise new and creative ways of taking fuller advantage of free markets, or every 7 or 8 weeks or so, in order to better serve people in need. I'm overstating for dramatic effect and conceivably a cheap laugh, but not by much. Yet once we finally did open shop 2 years later in 1990, I quickly came to realize that, as assumptions go, my original one was fatally flawed. Not because my colleagues and I weren't reasonably imaginative, but rather, getting right down to it, there just aren't too many truly seminal ideas to be had when it comes to social policy. As a state and nation, we are assuredly rich when it comes to variations on old policy themes and initiatives. But if our goal is to make breakthrough progress, and if our further intention is to do so by taking greater advantage of private sector instead of taxpayer riches, then I have no hesitation in saying that human capital performance bonds are the most genuinely creative policy approach I have come to know anything about over these last two decades. Or, if you will, they are a truly seminal idea. Given, moreover, that they are conceptually rooted in the demonstrated success of Twin Cities Rise, it's also fair to say they are more realistically promising than the great bulk of other regularly proposed visions. I first met Steve Rothschild when he was still laying the groundwork for what turned out to be Twin Cities Rise, a market-based nonprofit organization which first aimed at helping very low-income men prepare for and get good-paying jobs, which is to say, not a social service arena historically thick with victories. I was privileged to discuss those early plans with him and wound up writing a couple of columns about what came to be a tangible success. Fast forwarding, I have once again been privileged to meet and talk with him, along with many others, about his newest venture. Suffice it to say, I have been struck by the passion and precision, the big-hearted soul and big business sophistication he has once again brought to a vital new project, one which clearly warrants a real-world Minnesota-based demonstration. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You know, members, I've got to stop right now, and Senator Dibble and my aide told me that Senator Jungbauer was hit by a car while jogging. He's got a concussion. He will be in Regents Hospital overnight, but gosh darn it, this guy has been through so much already, and just one quick moment, if I may ask you, just think about him for just a moment here, please. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's seems a little hard to go back to what we're working on after that. He has had a tough week. Our prayers are with him, definitely. There's also Mr. Frank Forsberg with United Way. I don't know if any questions for Mr. Perlstein on this. But
anybody have questions? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman, members.
And Mr. Bob DeBoer, if you'd like to come up from the Citizens League. Sean Kershaw was not able to come.
Please state your name, sir, and you may proceed.
Frank Forsberg, and I work as Senior Vice President at Greater Twin Cities United Way. I'm pleased to be here and pleased to speak on behalf of this very new and innovative idea. I have the privilege to work with more than 200 health and human service nonprofits here in the Twin Cities, have done so with United Way for more than 10 years, and prior to that worked another 20 years in the nonprofit sector. So I know this sector well, and I'm pleased to serve in this sector and am often inspired by the entrepreneurship and the innovation that many leaders provide in our sector. It's what's engaging, and it's what changes and transforms lives. And so I'm very pleased to be here on behalf of many members of the nonprofit sector. The economic downturn, as you all know, is difficult and challenging. It's especially challenging for our nonprofit sector. First and foremost, the people I work with are troubled by the fact that the number of families who come to them for services is, in fact, up. It continues to rise. And perhaps for them, the most heartbreaking is that they have to turn families away every day from services they know they need. And the bottom line is they do not have the resources they need to provide those services. We already have a gap. I want to make sure we know that, we understand that there are people in our community who are not getting the services they need. Revenue is down for virtually all types of revenue for the nonprofits. Direct donations from individuals, foundation grants, fees, and government contracts or government grants. And when we look into our crystal ball, as Mr. Rothschild has already said, the information from our state economist and demographer are clear. We're in a long-term structural deficit that will, in fact, last beyond the very difficult decisions you already have to make this year around the budget. So when I think about the nonprofit sector here, it is very strong. One thing I want you to know is that 15 years ago, United Way led the charge to make a significant shift in how funds were invested in the nonprofit sector. Other foundations have followed our lead. And the shift was from providing broad grants to agencies in which agencies accounted for units of service to families to very targeted program-level grants that now required measurable outcomes. Now, you've already heard in the opening testimony that Mr. Rothschild has taken this even to another level, and that is, let's receive the pay at the end of the delivery of service when the outcome is achieved. That's where this new idea is taking us. But I want you to know that 15 years of investment has already preceded this idea, in which the nonprofit sector is already well-skilled in developing and providing outcomes and making sure that they are measurable. So I want you to be assured that this sector is, in fact, ready and willing to engage in this idea. We personally at United Way have hosted a number of information sessions on this topic with more than 100 nonprofit executive directors. I want you to know universally they are willing to pursue this further, to be engaged as voluntary participants in this innovative idea. They understand there's some things that got to get discussed and worked out, but they are entrepreneurs at heart, and they see this as a provocative and innovative new strategy. They want to be part of it, voluntary parts of it. And finally, I want you to know that the United Way Board, a very esteemed board in our community with more than 50 members of business and community leaders, has in fact vetted this idea, discussed it thoroughly, and voted unanimously to support the pursuit of this innovative pilot. So on behalf of the United Way Board and 200 United Way members who we work with day to day, I want you to know we're in full support of testing this innovative pilot. We think it is provocative, and it has great promise. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Force.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I am totally confused on this one. Senator Rosen, could you kind of walk us through how, from kind of start to finish, an example of how this would work? Because I really don't understand this one. But
sure.
Senator, would it be beneficial to do the next testifier, and then we can get into all of those? If that's okay, Senator Goodwin.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forsberg. Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question for the gentleman from United Way.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to know, I think that I really appreciate that you came to testify, because part of the questions that I have for Senator Rosen later on is really around financing, because I think the concept is very good, and I appreciate that you're bringing this to us. But the whole issue of how the commissioner enters into contract and how do we get the money and when do we pay for it is unclear to me, so I'd like to ask those questions later on. But from what I perceive now, from what I understand it now, some of the small nonprofit organizations that may have an innovative idea to work with a small group of clients and may want to enter into a contract, they might not have the funding to do that and enter into the process and deliver this service. And they might want to test this pilot project, but then they will be paid later when they are able to demonstrate how the process worked out. Is United Way interested in partnering with the state to support with funding those innovative projects that will come out of a small organization that will not be able to really wait for this payment for a year or so, whatever the contract may stipulate with the state?
Mr. Forsberg.
Yes, thank you. The United Way Board has not, you know, thoroughly discussed that exact question, which is to what degree could we step forward and help support the incubation of perhaps new innovative ideas, or in fact taking perhaps where your idea was going and bridging funding for some of these smaller nonprofits. But I've had a number of conversations with other philanthropic leaders that we certainly understand this will be one of the roles that United Way and other philanthropic organizations could play as a partner with the state. So I'd want you to know, I think we would be a very willing partner and would want to discuss how we could play a role in making that work.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Torres Ray.
I think this is very important because my fear, I do appreciate this concept, and I think it's needed and is very interesting. My fear is that some of the smaller nonprofits may not be able to compete. So we will only be able to contract with the larger organizations, you know, Catholic Charities, whatever it is, you know, the larger organizations that already have enough money to be able to compete, provide the services, and get reimbursed. And so I would like to see a little bit of more conversations with people like United Way and other foundations and see how they can support these efforts so that we have the funding available for the smaller nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and perhaps Mr. Rothschild can also address that, Senator Torres Ray, to explain how these organizations can continue on when they are paid at the tail end instead of the beginning. And he can address that.
Can we move on to the testifier? And then, because I know there's going to be a bunch of questions after the last testifier here. Please.
Greetings, Senator Perry, members of the committee. My name is Bob DeBoer. I'm Director of Policy Development for the Citizens League. We have endorsed a pilot of the Human Capital Performance Bonds. Our Pathways to Prosperity project was basically been looking at ways to get new investment directly into human capacity, which is key to our operating principles. We think this is the kind of idea that can really do that, but this is to pilot it. We know that what Senator Torres Ray is asking, those questions are hugely important, and that's why we need to test this pilot. We need to watch closely how it's done. I think it's very true that some of the smaller nonprofits will have the best ability to show particular outcomes with a targeted group where we know that we're not going to get the outcomes if we just stick with our current systems. And I think that's where the rubber hits the road on this pilot. And how broadly it can go after being piloted, I think, is one of the questions we'll be asking. I think it's very important to realize that if we don't start attracting other resources, whether it's from the philanthropic community, whether it's from the private sector investing in these bonds, that we are not going to be able to focus on working with people and getting them to better points. It's not just good for them, but better for society as a whole. And I think there is some realization on our analysis of this idea that this is not a broad replacement for other types of things we do. This is about targeting where we can get those outcomes with working directly with groups of people with demonstrated projects. And I think how far we can expand is going to depend on how well the pilot works. Once you start moving this money through the system and you show and you can bond, now you're talking about more resources really coming in, and then we can have a new discussion about how far this approach can go. But I think the idea that we wouldn't test it now is something that we have to test this now. We really believe that strongly at the Citizens League. And that's all the time I'll take. I think there's a lot of great questions here, unless there's sure. questions directly from me.
Senator Rosen, I see Senator Harrington showed up. Yes, did you have something to say? You're on our testifier list here.
No, actually, Mr. Chair, he was supposed to be here to testify with me, and so I'm sorry, Senator Harrington.
We got bumped, I heard, and I ran over as quickly as possible.
Okay,
now to move forward, I want to go back to Senator Goodwin to let her start this part of the conversation off, as I promised her. Senator
Thank
Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rosen, you know, if you could just walk me through how this would work, I think it would help. Just confusing to me right now. Absolutely.
Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And at some point, too, I'd like to have Senator Harrington talk about his experience with something similar to what we're trying to do and his thoughts on that also. But if I could defer to Mr. Rothschild on the specific system or how it's going to all pan out, I would appreciate that.
Mr. Rothschild.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, the concept is that the state would sell appropriation bonds through underwriters. The state sells lots of bonds today. In 2009, it sold appropriation bonds for low-income housing that were brought forth in the House by Representative Clark and signed by Governor Pawlenty at the time, and they are in effect. So this would be sold through Piper Jaffray or Wells Fargo or others who sell bonds on behalf of the state right now. Private investors would purchase it. We've talked to banks, particularly would be interested in buying this bond because they get CRA or Community Reinvestment Act credit for it, and that enhances the return that they would get. But we've talked to people in pension funds and large foundations who see this as something that they would have in their endowment funds because they not only provide a market rate of return, but it's aligned with their mission. The money would then be deposited in what we're calling now a performance pool, which would be segregated from other state bonding or other budgetary matters, and overseen, as the bill shows, an advisory committee established by the Commissioner of Management and Budget. And that advisory committee would pre-certify nonprofits and other social enterprises, union organizations that wanted to participate, by demonstrating based on their outcomes that they have the ability to generate a return above the cost of capital to the state of dealing with the debt service, the interest, and paying back the principal. Now, where do they develop that value? The value develops in two ways. Number one, for example, a job training program would be working with somebody and increase their incomes as a result of the training. As a result of incomes going up, those individuals pay more in income tax and in sales tax. So that's additional revenue to the revenue department. As their incomes go up, their public subsidies that the state would pay go down rather appreciably. So they qualify for less as their incomes go up, low-income housing, low-income child care, low-income health care. And many people, depending on their profile, like the ones we work at Twin Cities Rides, were ex-felons, typically don't recidivize at the same rate. And there's an enormous savings there. So that money would be captured by the Commissioner of Management and Budget by tracking every individual that that works through these nonprofit organizations by their Social Security numbers. They would have to sign waivers to allow that to happen, but many of them are doing it now for various purposes. And so we could track the exact amount that each individual pays in greater taxes and the lower use of subsidies as a result of the intervention that the nonprofit organization has created for the state. And it's out of those savings that the MMB would capture from the various areas of government that they would pay the interest and amortize the principal. It's our estimate based on the economists that are working on it. Art Rolnick is working on it. Jay Kodrowski, who some of you know, is an advisor to us. Peggy Ingeson is an advisor to us. Pam Wheelock is an advisor to us. That the amount of return that these nonprofits would recreate is going to be higher than the debt service. And as a result, the state would have what is called positive arbitrage. They'll make more money than the cost of servicing the debt. And that money could go into the general fund to support other human services. I hope that addresses the question you asked. It's a complex idea in many respects because it's not been done before. On the other hand, it uses tools that are readily used every day. The state sells bonds. Investors buy bonds. The idea of return on investment is becoming an important concept in the nonprofit community. It's been used in the consumer world and commercial world for years. So we are adapting ideas and concepts that have been successful to help our human services and help our nonprofits serve more needy people. That's what this is about, bottom line. If I may clarify something for Senator Torres-Rae, the question of where do you get working capital, particularly if you're a small organization, is an important one that you raised. And our expectation is we will raise a fund called a public program-related investment fund that foundations create to provide working capital to those organizations that need it to kickstart their initiatives in this area. So we will heartily endorse smaller organizations, and this will give them a fair playing field.
All right. Before we go to Senator Cohen, Senator Harrington, I'd like to hear your testimony or what you were going to add here.
Senator Perry, Mr. Chairman, thank you for your indulgence for my tardiness in getting here. I'm coming here to support this bill. Based on my experience as the CEO of a small nonprofit that's a startup, actually. It's a nonprofit that is actually the grandchild of Mr. Rothschild's project, and we call our project called Ujamaa Place, which is a Swahili word that stands for extended family. It's a nonprofit that's designed to serve 18 to 28-year-old young men, primarily African-American, who are coming out of the criminal justice system, who are predominantly homeless, less well-educated than they need to be, have been out of work for a significant period of time, and have a variety of other social issues that, if they are not addressed, they will continue to be a net drain on the state of Minnesota. Part of what brought me to Ujamaa Place was the recognition from my earlier job as chief of police that we could not arrest our way out of crime and that we really needed to do more on the intervention and the prevention end if we were to actually ever have any real success in reducing the crime rate. When I began having that conversation with funders, one of the things that I found that was most persuasive to them was the return on investment argument. When I described that it was $50,000 for us to have them incarcerated at Stillwater, $45,000 if I have them at Red Wing, if I have to keep them in long-term treatment, it's a $300 a day program in some cases. And I said, in comparison with that, if you provide money to our nonprofit for a few thousand dollars, we will commit to providing GED education, employability skills, the soft skills that they need, some of the hard skills they need, work with them on their chemical dependency issues, work with them on housing and homelessness, work with them on their family dynamics, that we expect that, A, we will keep them out of jail, because the numbers are really very clear that recidivism, once you get them employed and once you do this kind of work, drops down to really minimal levels. But beyond simply the fact that it won't cost the state $50,000 a year to keep reincarcerating them. And that's just the corrections cost. That's not police, county attorney, city attorney, probation, all of the other subsidiary costs that go into that. But not only do we promise that, but it's our expectation that they will pay their child support, which means that the county won't be paying that anymore, that they will be getting jobs, which means they will be paying taxes, which will ultimately subsidize them, that they will be working, and therefore they will then be eventually prosper to the point where they will be truly completely functioning, not just minimally functioning, but completely functioning partners in our community. Looking at that return on investment argument, businesses, corporations, and philanthropic organizations decided that we were worth a chance to the tune of almost $1 million. But for the $1 million that we did get, there were $3 million in philanthropic dollars that we were told we didn't get because the corporation now only focuses on children, or they only focus on the elderly, they only focus on housing, and we didn't fit their niche. And one of the real struggles for us and for a lot of nonprofits like us is that there isn't consistent funding streams for this population. I will fully admit that the population that I work with is probably not the poster child. I mean, it's not the puppies and kittens poster child that most people want to fund. These are bad guys that came out of jail in a lot of cases that don't look particularly friendly, but if we don't take care of them, I would argue that we're all going to pay the cost. This proposal provides a mechanism for nonprofits like mine and others to be able to have a funding stream that will produce that return on investment that right now banks and corporations are seeing as in their best interest, both from a financial point of view and also from, I believe, an altruistic or a social point of view, that as good corporate citizens, they believe that it is part of their responsibility to help these people help themselves because that's good for the community at large. I like this proposal because I think it really does jumpstart good organizations. I also like it because it will hold organizations, nonprofit organizations, accountable for the results. I don't really much like giving people a blank check, even though I've been asking for one for the last year or so for my corporation, for my nonprofit. Part of the argument for why I think they're giving it to us rather than somebody else is that we have somewhat of a track record of success, largely because we are working with some of the same philosophy that Twin Cities Rise and other organizations like Jeremiah have worked with. And so we have a track record, at least philosophically, of success. I think it's hard to make that argument to a business that you should just give a blank check to somebody who has not proven themselves. I like this because this really does put the money with performance. It is not simply a matter of you wish well and therefore we're going to give you some money. This is really much more a matter of you have to perform to earn the dollars. And I think that really fits my sense of a good investment. I normally don't invest if I don't think there's not just a reasonable chance of return on investment. This, I think, gives us a reasonable chance for return on investment. It allows us to do the right thing socially. It allows us to supply money for nonprofits who are doing some of the toughest work out there. They're doing some of the work with populations that nobody else really wants to touch, the mentally ill, the homeless. Some of those really, really tough and intransigent community issues are exactly what this pool of money was, I think, would be meant to do. To work with. So I am very much supportive of this, both from a person who runs a small nonprofit and also from someone who has a district who has a significant number of the issues that this kind of money would help to answer. The east side of St. Paul has a significant homeless population. It has some significant problems with gangs and folks coming out of incarceration. It has significant problems with folks that are sex offenders who are living in the community. Having nonprofits that can work on that are funded through this pool, means that perhaps the county won't have to fund them, but that they do need to be funded is not really arguable, at least in my backyard.
All right, thank you. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, a couple questions. Mr. Rothschild, obviously the legislature has appropriated small amounts of money to a variety of nonprofits. Without getting into what Sarah Michelle has done with some of that in his committee, where he's put together a grant program, I think what Sarah Michelle anticipates is the same kind of grants, but to do it on with a little bit more in-depth, possibly. So keeping apart from that, would you anticipate, hypothetically, let's stay away from Twin Cities Rise, let's talk about, I don't know, Women Venture, you know, something else that has often been a grantee. Would Women Venture be able to work through this plus get an appropriation, say, let's say Senator Michelle's bill or what he proposes becomes law. Would there be two opportunities, or is it one per customer? What would be anticipated?
Mr. Rothschild.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I'm not familiar with that bill, but the intention of this bill is to provide incremental money, not to supplant what the appropriation might otherwise be. On the other hand, it's not for the purpose of double dipping either. So no nonprofit would get paid an appropriation if they get an appropriation for working with individual X and then also qualify for these incremental funds to work with the same individual X. This would allow them to grow and reach scale and reach more people in the way Mr. Forsberg indicated. I mean, there's demand out there that isn't being met with the resources that the state or philanthropy provides today. And this would enable us to enable those organizations to grow who can best demonstrate success.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I could answer that too.
Senator Rosen.
Senator Cohen, there is an advisory board, and I think that's a very good question that Senator Cohen brings up, and that would be part of the advisory board's mission is to make sure that the funding is, there is no double dipping, that it's consistent, but that these measurable outcomes are managed. And so that would be part of the advisory board.
Follow-up, Senator Cohen, then we're going to go Thompson and Ortman.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question to Senator Rosen. As I read the draft, it doesn't appear to be limited to nonprofits. Am I misreading this?
Right. Senator Rosen?
No. Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, it's to nonprofits, unions, other state programs. Mm-hmm. So you could actually think more broadly, not just to workforce development. You could do higher ed. You know, you could do something in the health arena with some of the programs out there, nonprofit programs. The point is that this is a pilot program. We want to make sure that this succeeds, and this advisory board is going to have a tight control over it, and that we are focused on net results.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, to follow up on that, when this was presented to me yesterday, and as I've listened to the testimony, which I have found intriguing, it's all been around nonprofits. If we're going to get away from nonprofits, then I would suggest it raises other questions. I don't know if there's another kind of draft that's needed, but the testimony has all been centered on nonprofits. I haven't heard discussion of other entities. I'd be interested in supporting this, but only if it's for the purpose that it's been at least described to be for.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, I actually just wanted to move an oral amendment to fill in a blank, a literal blank. Bill, if you go to page 3, line 23, you'll notice that there is a dollar amount left blank there, just some dots. I would move that line 23 be changed to include the amount $20 million. So the line would read, however, comma, that bonds issued and unpaid shall not exceed $20 million in principal amount. I would move that oral amendment.
Mr. Bodern?
Mr. Chairman, that works fine, just the way Senator Thompson read it.
Senator Rosen, are...
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you, Senator Thompson. I would agree with that. That
are there,
would be consistent.
Any questions on that oral amendment? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. I think we were at Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen and Senator Harrington, thank you for your work on this. This is groundbreaking, and I appreciate it. And to those of you that are working in the private sector to help us with this, I appreciate your work too. I do have some questions, and I appreciate that it's a pilot project. And so I don't necessarily need answers. But I think there are really important questions that I hope that you'll consider going forward. For instance, it would be a lot easier for me to support this. I'm not saying I don't support it, but it would be a lot easier if the money to pay the upstart costs came from the private sector as well, instead of it coming from our state's general fund to leverage to raise the money for the bonds. I think that commitment would show their skin in the game, if you will, that it's not all taxpayer money at risk here, when we start the pilot program. If folks are so confident that this is a great idea, maybe those funds to pay for the debt service on the bonds should be maybe split, or maybe should be generated in the private sector for support. Again, I'm not asking for an answer here. I'm just offering some suggestions or some things that I'm thinking about. Another question I would have is how do you identify the targets or the folks that you're going to help? How do you identify them? Are they folks that are easy to help, or are they folks that are hard to help? I worry about that. It might be very tempting to help the easiest to help because you can help them very quickly and get a return on an investment very quickly. And that makes me a little uncomfortable when we're talking about people, I'll be honest. How do you measure the starting place? Are they getting better already? Are they falling behind? Are they falling off benefit systems, or are they just coming on to benefit systems? How do you measure all that? And I know you don't have answers yet because this is a pilot project. I know that. Mm-hmm. But these are just the things that I'm worrying about when I see this proposal going forward, and I think the general public would worry about. It's just common sense questions here. Another would be, what do you do about late changes? Meaning, you've helped someone in year three, excuse me, but in year seven, that person commits another crime. Do we go back? Where do we go with that? The performance has been provided. There's been a return on investment. There's supposedly a payment made. How long is a long-term assistance? And how do we measure that? I mean, I know that those are the things you're going to have to grapple with if we approve the pilot project. But I just want you to know what I'm thinking, so maybe you can take those issues forward as you consider this bill and move it forward to the legislature. I think my questions wouldn't be uncommon among folks that you're trying to explain this proposal to.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Ortman. And actually, Senator Cohen, both of your questions are good. This, again, is a pilot. There are many questions out there. I think to your first question, Senator Ortman, is who is going to apply or vie for this pilot project has already been receiving state dollars. So they're here, and they know that our general fund dollars are short, and they have the possibility of getting cut. They are probably up to that level of return on investment, know that they have to have outcomes because they could possibly be cut. So that's one of them. And then I'm going to defer to Mr. Rothschild on several other points.
With respect to your question, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, if I can remember them all. Number one, with respect to where's the money going to come from, there will be no money required from the general fund at all as we conceive it in the pilot or if the pilot's successful. As a result of being a pay-for-performance, the organizations don't get paid until the value accrues to the state. And it's that value, that cash that is accruing, that will pay the interest and the principal on the bonds. So our expectation is there is no general fund money required to pay debt service on this.
Excuse me on that point, Mr.
Senator Ortman.
Sorry, then I'm misreading the fiscal note that I have here. Is there something different or something incorrect about this? Because it says that there would be a cost to the general fund from the Commissioner of Management and Budget in order to develop and pay for these bonds.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, that fiscal note was developed before we had discussions with the department. And so that reflects two things that, number one, it only shows the cost side. It doesn't show the revenue side. They didn't have a way of being able to develop the revenue side. So all you see is the debt service that they anticipate and not the revenues coming in to offset it. Number one. And number two, the interest rate they'd used in that debt service assumed a 20-year bond. We're talking about a 10-year bond. And instead of having a 6.5% interest rate, Wells Fargo, as of yesterday, reported that the interest rate would be 4.2%. So our expectation is that the debt service would be quite a bit lower than the fiscal note suggests based on different assumptions. And furthermore, that doesn't show the revenue side. So we think that it'll balance out at the very least, and perhaps be positive over time. With respect to ensuring that the most worthy people get help, our expectation is that this is going to improve that situation. Today, the state in its contracting pays on the basis of cost. You get $3,000 a head or $1,200 a head. The incentive in an organization in a situation like that is that you work with people that aren't going to cost you any more than $3,000 a head. So if you take a look at what happens today, is there's an overwhelming number of nonprofits working with easier people than the most difficult people, like Senator Harrington suggested. In this model, you get paid for the value that you create, not for the cost that it is. And when you get cost paid for value, people who were ex-cons, who had tough lives, who you can turn around, are much more valuable to the state and save the state much more money. And so the incentive will turn on its head, and organizations will be incented to work with more difficult people because they'll get rewarded for it. So I think with respect to those two questions, we feel comfortable. We now have a group of economists that are analyzing where this could work in various areas of government. The Wilder Foundation has been contracted to provide that service. And as I indicated, Art Rolnick and Raymond Robertson from McAllister and others are overseeing that. We are looking for those organizations that can demonstrate outcomes, that want to participate in a pilot. And the $20 million would be very helpful because we'd like to do this in two or three areas. We'd like to do it in workforce. We'd like to do it in perhaps disability. We'd like to do it in low-income housing and demonstrate the viability of this across various areas of government in such a pilot. But thank you for your questions. We're going to have many more. And that's the point of trying it. We can't anticipate everything.
I know we have some members that are coming on some commitment lines here. I have two, Senator Dibble, and then we'll go to Senator Olson. So, Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I also come to this proposal very interested and supportive. So my questions are in the same spirit as Senator Ortman's. They're in the spirit of support. And actually, we don't even have to answer them now. They're just some, you know, because I know there's probably a little bit more of a road, a little bit more of a path for this legislation to move on. But and if we've touched on it, I apologize. But you know, I'm interested in figuring out exactly how we construe the value of, you know, that we deem the savings, and from that how we determine what the payment to the service provider would be, you know, how we determine that increment and who gets to taste how much of that increment. I'm also interested as a corollary in perhaps an idea of rolling, you know, those resources that we retain to the general fund, maybe keeping those segregated so it can continue to fund this idea, perhaps through those savings, keep a separate corpus, if you will. I'm interested in the advisory committee. I mean, I know this is an oversight committee internal to the agency. You know, so we don't necessarily need to give it the full ANREST treatment, but it might be useful to go. And you probably don't know what I'm talking about, Mr. Rothschild, but Senator Rosen,
Senator Dibble, Senator Rest was the first sponsor of the Twin Cities Rise bill back in 1996.
Okay. Well, this is in her capacity as the chair of the local government committee. The last few years, she had a pretty stringent set of criteria that any of these sorts of entities that we set up internal to state government, kind of, we put them through a mill. It's all about being very thorough and buttoning up conflicts of interest, reporting requirements, who gets appointed, to what term, you know, what sort of compensation might be considered, et cetera, all that stuff. So the ANREST treatment might be useful.
Senator Dibble, I would agree. I have that same list, and before I walked in here, we had a long discussion about
good.
And so we will be obviously talking about that, yes.
Yeah. I think we addressed the $1.8 million that Senator Ortman asked about, the cost to MMB for setup. You know, I'm also wondering, you know, we didn't just invent innovation yesterday. So we do a number of things already in state government that are pretty innovative, that save money, waivered services, other sorts of things. And so I'm interested in you know, if we can figure out, maybe not today and not through the pilot, but think about those sorts of things. This might even be a way to reform our fiscal note process. We do things that are innovative that we know save money, but we don't ever
have any way of capturing and knowing that in real dollars that we attribute to numbers on pieces of paper. And then I'm just curious, I know we've done appropriation bonds, we did it for housing, we did it for the stadium at the university, but I'm generally interested in MMB's opinion of I'm certainly not pure, I voted for those things, but generally how MMB feels about appropriation bonds. We are binding a future legislature, and we have the kind of scary language in the bill, the full faith and credit of the state, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, just kind of a little due diligence there for going down a good path or for stepping down a path that we started a little further that maybe we shouldn't. You know, just kind of a due diligence question. Don't have to answer these now unless you really want to. But like I said, I like the idea. It's innovative. Everyone seems to be in love with it. Why shouldn't I be?
Sure. Let's move on to Senator Olson here before we answer.
We're not going to be contrarians today. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I should start being a little more contentious now if everybody loves it.
Please don't.
We've had that already.
You need a contrarian every now and then. I think we've learned that.
I use that up
in
the
this committee. Yes. I'm just interested if you have, in all of your deliberations thus far, you've determined how long a pilot would need to be a pilot before you would see the kind of results that would be regular to, ready to bring it to scale. Now, Senator Dribble talked about the government. I've been thinking this is essentially focused on the nonprofit, and I think they have some greater freedoms to do some innovative things in the process of trying to achieve those results that I would think that our government could learn from and possibly see how to remove some of either the barriers or redirect some of their approaches with the things they fund, or else let it be in the nonprofit sector as a very effective way of getting the results. But how long do you envision a pilot needing to be a pilot? Because you don't have any dates in it, and I'm not suggesting you need them. But it'd be interesting to know.
Mr. Chair, I'm
just
sorry.
A minute here. You know, that's what's great about chairing a great committee, because every question that I've wanted to ask is already being asked. And I was, right before Senator Olson spoke, I was concerned. I wrote it right down here. Is there a sunset? How do we know when the end, and how do we look at that? So please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, we don't have a fixed date on that, because I think a lot of it depends on how it goes and how long it takes to go. But that shouldn't be a concern, because we have the way the legislation is written is that that there's an ability to issue so many bonds up to a certain amount. And what we want to do is get started with at least one pod of nonprofits, probably in the workforce area, because we're more ahead in that area, and we've been working with DEED for a number of years now through the United Way to get return on investment data. It'll take a little longer to start the others up. We are now working on an evaluation plan with Wilder, and we haven't completed it. But my guess is, if I were to estimate, it would be, if it doesn't work at all, we'll know it pretty soon, and we can close it down. But if it works reasonably well, it'll take a little longer to figure out. And I would say 3 years minimum. And that what I would hope would happen is we would start, and is if it looks good in this arena and we can demonstrate that we can do it in another arena, we would come forward a whole another group and suggest that we try it in another area. But that would be the responsibility of a future legislature. So the answer is, I think, 3 years, probably minimally, before we have some kind of conclusive ideas about how well it can work. But this will build over time. This will build over time. Thank you for your question.
Senator Dibble.
I had another question that I forgot to write down, so then I forgot to ask it. And that is, how do we, and again, it doesn't have to be answered today, just kind of hang it out there. There are some things, some good ideas that we know will save money, and Art Rolnick talks a lot about early childhood, of course, and we won't realize those savings for a long time, one, two, three, or, in the case of early childhood, we won't really know if we've been successful until kids become adults. So how do we how do we account for multi, you know, we all operate on the annual, biannual cycle. It's a problem. It's a handicap in state government, it's a handicap in, even in private business. We're looking at the next quarter, the next year. And so how do we deem those savings and attribute
them? Mr. Rothschild.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, excellent question. One of the benefits of this, and it speaks to Senator Olson's a point that you made, is that state government looks for a return in 2 years based on the cycle of state government. Well, you don't get a return. You get an output at best, not an outcome. In a 10-year bond, private money is more patient than public money. And private investors are willing to put money into a bond for 10 years. And so the returns accrue over time. They get bigger and better. And that's why businesses make decisions and look out more than 2 years when they're making a major growth or productivity investment. This will allow nonprofits or social enterprises to make more strategic decisions than they have been able to do heretofore, and that will lead to better outcomes. Just another point about appropriation bonds, I should have mentioned, we need to kickstart this with an appropriation bond because there's no knowledge about whether this will work, and no investor would invest in something like this unless they demanded 100% return. I mean, it would become impossible to implement. But once it was established, and we can show the fidelity of this, that we're generating returns, they're paying the debt service, we no longer need the state to bond it. The oversight committee or another private organization could issue the bonds themselves, much like occurs in other areas of government today. You have housing financial groups, you have regional financial groups that issue bonds in this manner. And we would expect that state bonding would only be required to get this up and running and not be required long term.
All right. I think we're where we need to go at this point. I know there's going to be more discussion when it gets into capital investment, but sitting here, you need to know that I'm really not one that likes to grow more committees, and I think you, Senator Rosen, I think you know that about me. But I'm excited about this. I think there's some great potential. I'm concerned about the sunset factor. I'm concerned that the commissioner can really hone down to a very small portion, those on the committee, and I really think we need to take a strong look at that committee structure because lack of better terms, I don't want it to become a good old boys club here. I think we need a little bit stronger representation there. But, you know, I, for one, really like the concept, and I think it's got some good things for the citizens of our state. So, Senator Daley.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 434 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the capital investment.
Senator Daley moves
it.
Senator Cohen.
I have an amendment, and I indicated some concern relative to how this bill has been presented to myself, both yesterday and in the committee. It's been presented as something to be of utilization by the nonprofits in the state, and I'm very supportive of that. Take great pride in the fact that I think about 10 years ago I was the Council of Nonprofits gave me the Legislator of the Year Award. So I think we get a lot for the utilization of nonprofits. And I agree with Mr. Rothschild in terms of problems that nonprofits have. I'm on, I think, two or three nonprofit boards, and understand the difficulty, particularly for the smaller nonprofits who are providing huge supplemental services, as Senator Harrington suggested, as Mr. Rothschild has testified, in terms of folks, in terms of counseling, employment, a variety of services that are of great supplemental help to the state. But as this legislation is drafted, it goes far beyond that. And Senator Rosen, you offered some concern to me. You talked about the utilization by, say, health services. Well, we just had the bill authored by Senator Hahn in terms of PEEP.
and raised all sorts of questions. So when we get into the morass of healthcare services, you know, for-profit healthcare services, who knows what that opens up? Additionally, I know that a lot of the votes around this place have, to be fair, have been, you know, divided by party line. And, you know, I'm looking forward to when we can do some of this on a bipartisan basis. But at the end of the day, this to pass the bill, it's got to be signed by the governor. And I know when we pass, if you allow me, Mr. Chairman, the reference to where we've been the last several years, because I've been in your position. And when we've passed finance bills, tax bills, omnibus tax bills, obviously those of us who've been here over the last several years know that that has been done on usually a partisan basis, as has been the case with the finance bills and the tax bill in this Senate. But it could be limited. And there are going to be some significant differences in terms of tax and finance policy. So when we get to the policy bills, the strictly policy bills, I know I would always look, I mean, sometimes I authored bills that I thought Governor Plenty would not sign. I knew he would not sign them. There were some points I was trying to make, particularly relative to the finance process. But when I worked on other legislation, I was always concerned about, at the end of the day, would Governor Plenty sign my legislation? And I had a number of bills signed by Governor Plenty. And so, Senator Rosen, if your intent is to actually pass this bill and have it become law, I would suggest you think about what's going to be of success with the governor. And I'd be very surprised if the governor were to sign a bill that would be as broad as it's written right now, particularly when the discussion has been centered on nonprofits. So I'd like to move an amendment, and I've asked Mr. Bodern for some language and see what happens.
Mr. Bodern.
Mr. Chairman, the suggested amendment for Senator Cohen would be on page 2, line 6, after the period, insert, the selected provider must be a nonprofit corporation. And this basically would limit contracts using these proceeds to contracts with nonprofit corporations as provided in this subdivision.
Mr. Chairman, would move that amendment.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wigger.
A question, Mr. Chair. Senator Cohen, is that any nonprofit corporation, whether in Minnesota or elsewhere?
That's a good point. I was assuming it would be a Minnesota nonprofit.
So, Senator, Mr. Bodern, would you just insert must be a Minnesota nonprofit corporation?
Mr. Chairman, I think that would work for our purposes right now.
All right.
So I incorporate that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Discussion on the Cohen oral amendment, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern would be, and I know that we have extremely bright and capable people in our nonprofits, but I would hate to think that we would shut out ideas and innovations from anyone at any time that would help the people of the state of Minnesota and save the state of Minnesota money. I just think that that's unconscionable. If this idea is good, it's good for whoever's got the best and brightest ideas as it's run through the committee, as the committee is set up. And so I would oppose Senator Cohen's amendment.
Right. Mr. Chairman,
let me stop right here because I would like to hear from the author who, before we discuss any further, so Senator Rosen.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Cohen, I understand I had no intention of taking it down to eliminate the, you know, the testimony from the previous bill. We've talked about some of the programs dealing with health care for the disabled, as Mr. Rothschild mentioned. And I think just limiting to the nonprofits would eliminate some of those union programs or service programs that are actually providing a very good service out there. And I think those would be beneficial to keep in. The main purpose of the bill is to have the accountability, to have the outcome measures, and make sure that these programs that take state dollars, there is a measurable outcome to it. So I understand your angst, and I did not, this is not going down to supplanting or taking away general fund dollars to any of the healthcare or changing it all up. This is just thinking broadly, that's all.
Well, Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, and Senator Carlson, I understand what you're saying, but I have to admit then, this whole discussion is a little bit of a bait and switch, because what was presented to me yesterday, I had a chance to talk to Mr. Rothschild and representatives, folks representing the interests of this, was it centered on nonprofits. Every piece of testimony, every minute of the testimony we've heard today has been centered on nonprofits. If we're going to go down the road as suggested by Senator Carlson, I'm not necessarily opposed to that. I think there are other issues we have to take a look at. You know, I think we would need obviously another committee hearing to do so. I'm not going to support a bill that is that broad, and we haven't had the discussion whatsoever about it. And as I suggested, Senator Rosen, I would be interested, if I were you, I'd be interested in what might happen with the chief executive who ultimately has to sign the bill.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I understand just what the limitation or what the concern is. Obviously, the selection of it, if it's a for-profit organization, they obviously have some money to operate with, and I think you're looking at some that need, you know, are willing to go for the results and need some resources to do it. And so obviously it seems more natural that there will be nonprofits, but you have a statement in here that it would appear that a government agency or entity could also be competitive for this. Because in the first, on 2.4 and 5, the commissioner and the commissioner of the agency with a service to be provided through the pilot program shall enter into a contract with a selected provider. With a selected provider. Is that, how am I missing something here, or is there other agencies that are involved with the provider, or is provider being used in more than one, with more than one meaning in that sentence?
Senator Rosen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, Senator Cohen, the language in here says provider because the intention was to enable any current provider or any provider to the government to potentially participate if they can demonstrate results. When we refer to nonprofits, and that's my error, was unintentional, we expect 95%, 97% of the participants to be nonprofits because they are the ones that overwhelmingly are contracted with. But we didn't want to eliminate unions that may not be 501c3 organizations that are already providing services to the state and might qualify, and any other kind of organization where the state would get a benefit. And that was the intention of it. And I apologize to you if I just use the word nonprofit because I have the tendency to, since it's around 95 or 97% of the users, that's why we refer to it. But the legislation does talk about providers more generally. If we didn't think that there would be a problem with that, there wouldn't be a problem with it, we don't want to create a problem with that. That's not the intention of this. We want to be pragmatic about it. But that I just wanted to explain why it says provider and not nonprofit per se.
And Mr. Chairman, very quick response.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Senator Rothschild, you don't have to apologize. Everybody else has made the reference to nonprofit. It wasn't just you.
Okay. All right. Before I go to Senator Lilly, I want to go to Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I just wanted to also kind of clarify the use of the term nonprofit, because a lot of the organizations that we've worked with, both in my prior job and as CEO of Ujamaa Place, are in fact union shops that we're working with. So, for example, working with OIC and Lewis King, who are working with the Teamsters and with the 49ers to train our folks as heavy equipment operators. We're training them how to get level Class C licenses so that they can run dump trucks and get other commercial vehicle licenses so that they can work in the union. So the union is part of the partnership, and in some cases I think of them as they're one part of the partnership. In some cases, they're the leading part of the partnership, as in the Carpenters Union and the 49ers. In other cases, they're a secondary part of this. But the one of my concerns with if we said just nonprofits would be that that might preclude unions from continuing to be involved. And I think they have been a very strong component of both diversifying their shop, which I think is their benefit out of this, but also getting young men back into the workforce in a way that's not only got long-term it has long-term sustainability, but also has very much a living wage. So these young men who probably aren't necessarily going to go off to Harvard can make a living well enough to support their household, support themselves, and to become participants in the community. So,
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, if there's any room left on the bandwagon, thanking Senator Rosen for bringing this forward, I'd like a spot on that also. I think this is very innovative, creative, and a very positive discussion. Senator Cohen, I'm not going to agree with you on your motion, but I do agree with you on the fact that this is a work in process, and that there are a number of questions that have been raised throughout this discussion, and I'm not fully confident that I have my arms around what the concepts that are being presented to us are today. And I do have questions as to what steps will this bill go through before we vote on it on the floor. And that being said, it's something that I think we all will want to invest time and energy in understanding and trying to get to that point that we can support this when it's at the floor. And I'm not sure that I'm entirely at that point yet either. So I think there are a lot of questions that many of us have voiced we both supported and yet questioned, and I think that this is something that we need to keep working at, because innovation is something that is challenging. This is something that's new. This is a new way of looking at things, and we need to work at it. So I will not support your amendment, but I agree with your contention or your feelings that we need to evolve this further before we vote on it on the floor.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a minute, Senator Lilly, and I would agree with you because, you know, I'm challenging you, Senator Rosen and Senator Harrington, on that I am sure that this committee will want to see answers to many of the questions that have been brought up here, because I, for one, I'm at the position where I'm willing to move this out of committee and into capital investments. But I can tell you that I will be uncomfortable if I don't see or get answers to these, that I could see myself asking it to be re-referred back to this committee if we don't get some satisfaction on some of these questions that will help all of us here that I'm hearing the questions of. I mean, I think we're all in favor of this innovative idea to move forward. It seems to be a cool thing here, and we're willing to take the word of Senator Harrington, who has seen this, and Rothschild. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, time out. This is the committee. I like the concept. It's possible that I could be convinced to withdraw my amendment. There's nothing magic about this afternoon, I don't think. I'm not sure when how the deadline is working, but we've had questions. Mr. Chairman, Senator Lilly has not raised particular questions as you and Senator Ortman have. I've raised one broad question. Let's lay the bill over and have another hearing. This is the committee. We're not going to do this work in the Finance Committee. Certainly we're not going to do this work in the Capital Investment Committee. And to suggest we're going to have a report coming back to us after the fact just acts in contravention of the committee process. This is the committee. Mr. Chairman, the majority wanted to set up a process this year different from what we did, where there was a combination of finance and policy. You got it. So I think it abrogates the responsibility of this committee to not work out some of these problems and concerns. That's what you do. You don't just rush things through the committee process. And I don't care who's in the majority, but that just belies the committee process.
You know, Senator Rosen, I didn't ask you beforehand. I mean, are you amiable? I mean, is that something that you're willing to do?
Mr. Chair, first of all, I'd like to thank you and the members for this very extended period and hearing. And obviously, there are many questions about this bill, and I would feel very comfortable about bringing it back to this committee to vet some of these questions out, because I think they are very valid. We need to make sure that your questions are addressed and that you're comfortable. And hopefully, I will have a positive vote coming out of this committee. So, absolutely, if you would indulge me with another.
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my amendment.
Senator Cohen withdraws his amendment. Are there any other questions that we want to, because it will be my intent then to lay this over. So if we have questions, now's the time to throw them at him quick, or else email them, or however you want to move forward. Senator Dibble.
Just a suggestion. Senator Rosen has been very skilled in her chairmanship on the issues that she's been working on, or has encouraged members to have meetings outside of the committee to maybe work through language issues. So I don't know, Senator Rosen, I'd be delighted to sit down in a, you know, table with a few other folks mm-hmm. who are interested with these questions, Senator Ortman, others. To work through and develop some language
absolutely.
That then we could bring back to the committee jointly.
Mr. Berry, Senator Goodwin, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, thank you very much, and I would appreciate that opportunity to perhaps give some comfort to what we're doing in the full spirit that this is a pilot project. It is movable, and we can change it and make it sure that everybody has a comfort level. But I do think the basic premise and the bill itself is very good to make sure that we can still provide these services that are so desperately needed out there, but ensure that we have outcomes that as taxpayers, as state officials, and the government can get our hands around and say, yes, it's worth funding and keeping these programs going. So I would appreciate some further work on this.
Then, members, I would suggest if those of you who would like to work in the meantime with Senator Rosen that you contact her directly, and that will be very beneficial. This has been great. Thank you, members.
Thank you,
Senate
Chair.
File 434 is laid on the table.
Thank you,
Senator Rosen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Perry.
Members, we will be meeting Monday at 1 o'clock regular time. You'll have a schedule out here shortly. Being there's no further business before the committee, meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Members.